All right, so it is my pleasure to move us to the next part. A pretty special treat that we have today. I have the honor of welcoming to stage right now, from Elle.com, Melissa Harris Perry. My role model, Miss Marley Dias. Who every time I see, literally, I think about, should I be reading more? Should I go back to school? What do I need to do? And the two women that Jordan and I have had the absolute honor and absolute privilege, and this might actually be our last time having the opportunity to welcome them to stage. They have been a light and an inspiration to us, and they have been warriors for this administration for issues pertaining to women and girls of color, women and girls across the country, and just everyday Americans. So I have the honor of welcoming to stage Ms. Valerie Jarrett and Ms. Tina Chen.
So my boss, Marley, dreamed this one up. The idea here is to, we've been hearing about girls, but the idea here is actually to allow, in many ways, Marley to drive this conversation. She and I had a our kind of pre-interview yesterday in which she developed what's going to happen here today. And so, Marley, I want to start by turning it over to you because these are really your questions. This is really your interview.
Okay, so hello, everyone. My name is Marley Dias. I am the founder and creator of the 1,000 Black Girl Books campaign, a campaign that strives to promote diversity in schools and communities pertaining to girls of color specifically. But today I wanted to have a conversation with the both of you about how you became strong women of color that you are now, and like what's your favorite color, what's your favorite food, and things that we don't get to hear and while we can still hear them. So my first question is to, can you guys tell us the story of how you both grew up and how did girlhood affect the women that you are now?
All right, well, thank you, Marley. Thank you, Melissa. And I have to thank Melissa while I'm on the stage here for really driving this conversation and for this amazing commitments, you know, in the academic front. So you have really made this work happen out there. So how I grew up. So I am the child of Chinese immigrants. My parents came to the United States right after World War II. In 1949, born in Columbus, Ohio, and I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah, okay, Ohio. You know, little story about my dad. Both my parents have passed, but you know, in China, you know, boys are like the thing, right? You know, you want to have a boy. So
turns out it might be the thing here too.
Yeah. So, you know, so I'm the firstborn in my family. My mother used to tell the story of how about 3 or 4 days after I was born, you know, and so first child, immigrant parents, they had no family. All their family was still back in China, so they're all alone in Columbus, Ohio. And my dad's kind of distracted, and he's running around, and he's realizing before, you know, we get discharged from the hospital, he turns to my mother and says, "We have to make sure we get the baby circumcised." She looks at him, and she says, "You remember it's a girl." Now, I have to say about my father, however, so he had two girls. My younger sister was a girl, so he only had two girls. That was the first and last time I think he ever thought about that. And then proceeded to pour into me and my sister everything he would have poured into a son. And, you know, gave us both encouragement and strength and every ounce of ambition that he wanted to have, and gave it to us, every bit of confidence. So that was amazing. To have two parents who were so supportive. So that's a big thing that I'm so grateful for and fortunate to have. But then a lot of my life was shaped growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, like one of maybe six Chinese families on the east side of Cleveland at that time. And being, you know, a distinct minority in a majority world there, and learning how both to be, you know, respect and grow to love my Chinese culture, even though I can't speak Chinese, but I do know great food and everything else, and great holidays and great traditions, and be connected to my family. Some of it was my parents started a Chinese family camp for kids in the Midwest, where we to this day, 60 years later, we still go. I take my kids to. But they had to work hard. My parents worked hard to make sure I had that cultural identity as well as living in a majority world. And I think that also, without even knowing it, gave me the strength, you know, both as a woman and as a Chinese woman, to grow into and understand that identity, be proud of it, and also in the face of when people don't look like you, continue to speak out. So I think that's how I kind of learned it when I started going into a lot of, you know, courtrooms and places like that where nobody looked like me. And I didn't kind of matter, because when I was a kid, I was always in rooms with people who didn't look like me.
Good story, yes.
So I am the daughter, only child of James and Barbara Bowman. My mom grew up in Chicago. My dad grew up here. They met and fell in love and got married. And my father was a physician, and decided to do something kind of crazy when he left the Army. And he was having a hard time finding a job in an academic institution at any of the universities here in the United States. And so out of frustration, he decided, well, let's just go and live outside of the United States for a while. So he started looking for opportunities, and he found an offer to go and help start a hospital in Shiraz, Iran. And my parents were kind of crazy, and I don't think either of them had been out of the country except for once to Europe at that point. But off they went after having been married for about 4 years to Shiraz, Iran. My father helped start the Namazi Hospital there. And I was the second baby born in the hospital. And so when people say to me, well, why were you born in Iran? I say, because that's where my mother was when she gave birth. So we lived in Shiraz for 5 years. We lived on a hospital compound. And at that time, the United States and Iran had excellent diplomatic relationship. And the leadership in Iran was recruiting physicians from all over the world to come and work with Iranian doctors and share best practices. And so on our hospital compound, we had people from, you know, every possible country. And so it was a very kind of cosmopolitan place to grow up. But after about 5 years, my parents decided that it was really hard to raise a black child in a different country with a different customs and traditions. And she wanted me to begin to think about, you know, my blackness. And so first stop, they moved to London for a year, and then back to Chicago. And we lived in Hyde Park, where my mom still lives today, which is one of the most integrated neighborhoods in the country. And it's affiliated with university, so you've got this kind of academic overlay on top of this rich culture of diversity. But I started in public school, and it was a predominantly black public school, and here I am. I speak three languages at that point: English, Farsi, and French. I skipped two grades because that's the education that I was getting actually in Iran and in London. So I'm five going on six in second grade, and I really got bullied a lot. And I remember those early days of trying to figure out how I fit in, and it took a lot from my parents to kind of instill in me, and the big family that I have. So even though I'm an only child, we lived in basically a family compound within about three blocks. We had about 35 relatives, and that's really where I got my sense of self and my sense of black identity from this family that we had. And I'm very fortunate, similar to Tina, that I had two parents who loved me dearly, gave me unconditional love, set very high expectations, and then gave me the safety net of protection in case I stumbled and fell, which gave me the latitude, I think, to take risks. And I think my dad never actually admitted it, but wanted a boy as well. And when I came, he said, all right, well, we'll make the best of this situation. So he treated me like, you know, the son he never had. So we played tennis together, and there was a lot of competition, and our family dinner table, both my nuclear family and then the larger family that would come over every Sunday for dinner, was always spirited in debate and conversation. But other than at that table, I was really pretty shy. And it may be hard for you to believe that now, but because I don't stop talking. But at that stage of my life, I really had to learn to grow out of my comfort with just my family. And it wasn't until I was a young adult, actually, that I developed my voice and the power of that voice. That's my story.
So what I love about this is when Marley and I were talking about why she wanted to start with your stories is we knew we were going to talk a lot about data, and we were going to talk a lot about you know, these questions of being women and girls of color, but those can feel flat. And so part of storytelling that we felt was so important is that you get inside of those numbers. You can get inside of the quantitative data. And one of the things that that Marley is working on is this idea that every one of these identities, an identity like, for example, black girl, is actually a lot more complicated. So you might say, oh, you know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago. People presume they know everything about you. Or, oh, yeah, I grew up in Cleveland. People think they know. But in fact, these stories help us to understand that even every one of these data points is actually still complicated. Did you get what you were hoping for from some of those stories, Marley?
Yes, I did. Thank you. Well, and my next question is that you both went to very elite, great universities, but how was it like for you being a smart, very smart girls of color in a very strong and competitive university, and especially for you because you were at a women's college and you went to law school, which was co-ed, so how was it like changing from an environment that was all about women to an environment that was not focused on them?
So actually, at the time I went to Radcliffe, I went to Radcliffe College at Harvard University. By the time I got there in 1974, Radcliffe had actually merged with Harvard. You know, they went through this long merger, non-merger, over a very long period of time, debating it. By the time I got there in 1974, they had not yet merged the admissions offices, so I was admitted and graduated from just Radcliffe University. But they had merged the housing, and all the classes had already been co-ed for a while. So I lived in co-ed housing. So it really felt like you were just at Harvard University. What I love about this story, for those of you who don't know it, is the next year in 1975, I was the last class to be just admitted to Radcliffe College. So the ratio was 3-1 because they capped the number at 400 girls, you know, 1,200 boys. The next year they merged the admissions offices, so they went to gender-blind admissions. Went in about 1 year to almost 50-50. Because the girls were so much better than the boys. I love that story. So like instantly went almost, when you did it just on merit, it went to like almost parity, 50-50 right away. So it wasn't that quite that experience. But my experience at Harvard was a little bit shaped by the fact that I came from public school. Came from public school in the Midwest. I was the second kid in my high school to ever go to Harvard. And that kind of messes with your head a little bit. I will say that even though I'd done really well and I came from a privileged background, going as a public school student to a place like Harvard in the 70s kind of messed with me for a while. And so FLOTUS talks about this. The First Lady talks about this a lot, too, being, you know, a black girl from Hyde Park, you know, from the public school system in Chicago, going to Princeton, and that you sort of feel out of place for a while, and I had that experience too. And it is really important. And I heard in the prior panel people saying you got to get past folks who question you and the doubters and the haters, and you got to block all that out. You got to do that thing where you're just not hearing it and discovering yourself, you know, how strong you are. I remember my first set of exams freshman year, panicked, like really panicked. I was totally convinced I did not belong there, right? And then guess what? I kind of did okay. So that's when you realize, I'm okay, I do belong here. It's something we tell kids and we bring them here to the White House all the time, that you're here at the White House now, you belong here. You belong here. What your background is, you've been already done stuff in your life that got you here to the White House, got this administration recognize you. You can never take that away. That means you belong anywhere.
So I had a different experience. I went to the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, private school in Chicago. And then for my last 2 years of high school, I went to a prep school, Northfield Mount Hermon. And I had an experience there that I'll never forget, because I decided my freshman year of high school that I wanted to go to Stanford because I was in the library and Mr. Poole, the librarian, introduced me to this tall, handsome man who was at Stanford. And no lie. And Mr. Poole said, you should talk to John Hope Franklin Jr. because he's at Stanford University. And John Hope said to me, you should go to Stanford. And I said, okay. And I'm telling you, it was a 30-second conversation, and I was sold. I didn't even, and he said it's in California, and I love warm weather. And so that's all it took. I never visited the campus, anything. But this is the story. So I, when it came time to apply for colleges, I went into my admissions or counselor at Northfield Mount Hermon, and I said, I want to go to Stanford. And he said, you'll never get in there. And he started giving me all these names of other schools. And so then I went home and I told my mom, and she said, well, apply to Stanford, but you better, if your counselor's telling you you're not going to get in, you better apply to a bunch of other schools too. So my parents and I sat down and we came up with 9 colleges to apply to. And I just remember going through that whole process thinking, well, why did he think that about me? What was it about me that he thought was lacking? But of course, the best thing about it was, as I started getting my acceptance letters, they were coming in one at a time, and Stanford was the last school that I heard from, and I got in the first 8. And when I got into Stanford, I went into his admissions office with those pile of letters, and I dropped them on his desk. And I said, if I had listened to you, I probably wouldn't have even applied to these schools. And I remember what it took, and I was so outraged at him because John Hope Franklin had convinced me that I should be going there. And so when I got to Stanford, I'll be honest with you, I kind of felt like maybe I didn't belong, and maybe it had been a fluke. And Stanford had, at that time, and I think still does, a dorm within a larger dorm called Ujamaa, and it's a diverse dorm, and it had a lot more black students than the rest of the campus did. And I remember telling my mother I wanted to live in Ujamaa, and she said, you grew up in a black house. Why do you think you need to live in a black house in college? You're going to college to expand your boundaries. But I think it actually helped me, and it helped me just feel a little bit more like I belonged. But it took me a minute to get out of that insecure shell that counselor had put me in. And I think part of what we have to do is to develop our own self-confidence and our own vision and our own dreams, and don't let anybody tell you that you can't succeed. You can try, and if I hadn't gotten in Stanford, I could have gone to one of those other 8 colleges, but boy, am I glad he didn't talk me out of applying. It's a big lesson.
So Marley, if it's okay, I'm gonna build on something there and jump forward in our questions just a little bit to the mentoring question that we have, because what I heard from that story is a little bit the kind of counter-mentoring, right? It's the one thing that you can hear that sticks with you for a long, long time. And I'm also thinking, though, on the other side, I can remember, for example, when I was getting my PhD and I was drowning, I always say the February of the first year of graduate school is like the lowest low point, so, and then it's March, and thank goodness. But I can remember being at my lowest low point and having a professor, John Aldridge, say, you know what, I think you might be good at this. And like, even right now, sometimes when I think I can't be. So mentors are extraordinarily important. But I'm convinced that women of color and girls of color need a slightly different kind of mentoring. That it's actually not just about us individually, but that we need what I like to call activist mentoring. So both like, let's get over this hurdle, but while we're getting over it, let's kick it down so it doesn't exist there for anybody else anymore. Marley had encouraged me to ask you all, how is it that you do mentoring, both the hands-on, high-touch mentoring right here with people like Jordan and Kalisha, but also when you've got rooms of people or maybe thousands of people who are asking advice, how do you do your mentoring?
Well, I'll tell you a story about a mentor of mine that I've shared with Tina many times. When I worked, I practiced law for 6 years at a private law firm and was miserable, just miserable. Tina thrived in a law firm, I did not, I was in agony. And I decided to join the administration of Harold Washington, who was the first African-American mayor of Chicago, and I worked in his law department. And my principal client was an African-American woman, Lucille Dobbins, who worked in the mayor's office. And she was in charge of finance and development in the mayor's office, and I was in charge of finance and development in the law department. And we grew to be very close friends. And the reason why activist mentor is such an important word is you don't just need somebody to do like a drive-by. You need somebody to actually invest in you. And as we, one of the advantages of having worked at this big law firm is that I did learn a lot about complex real estate. And I was doing sophisticated deals with her that actually were more advanced than what my supervisor could do. And so Lucille started nudging me about asking for promotion. How many of you have ever asked for a promotion? Show of hands. All right, well, in my wildest dreams, it never occurred to me to ask for promotion. I thought that one day my boss would wake up and decide I was worthy of a promotion and that it was impolite and presumptuous to do it. And so I just ignored her, and I ignored her for months. And it got to the point where activism, she would, at the beginning of every conversation, say, when are you going to go talk to Judd? And so she said, and prepare, go in there and don't just say, give me a promotion, tell him all the reasons. And she said, and I don't want you to just ask to go up one stop. I want you to be your boss's boss. I'm like, Lucille, that's ridiculous. Why would he do that? And she said, because I know the work you're doing, and I know the work that your boss and your boss's work boss do. Anyway, finally, I get the nerve up, and I go into his office, and I give him all the reasons why I should, I am worthy of this promotion. And I am sweating, really, clammy hands, down the face, and I know him really well. He's a friend of mine, but it took so much for me to do it. And so he looked at me over his glasses, and he said, okay. So then I said, and you don't have a woman in your front office suite. You have three offices up there, and there's no woman. I think you should have a woman. And he says, well, you are at the bottom of the totem pole of deputies, and so I got to let the other deputies have a first crack. And I said, well, how about this? I'll just move in until you decide who should have it. Well, I never moved out, of course. But my point is that Lucille really cared about me, and she pushed me to do something way outside of my comfort zone. And mentorship is really about relationships. And it's also somebody who will be an advocate for you. So they don't just coach you, but she put me at the table in the mayor's office when she didn't have to. She brought me to meetings that she really didn't need to include me in. She gave me visibility among people who were much more senior to me. And that's the activist mentor that I enjoyed. And as a result of that, I try to be that kind of mentor for the people in my life.
So just to piggyback on that story, one other piece of advice I got from a mentor of mine, Susan Gensendanner. So Susan was not your warm and fuzzy mentor. This is a woman who was the first federal judge in Chicago, and then she left to come to my law firm. And so Susan was not your like embrace you kind of mentor. But she was a challenging mentor, and one of the things she used to say when she first said it to a group of the young lawyers, I thought, well, that's a little harsh, but it has proved to be true, which is she said, no one will care about you and your career more than you. And just deal with it, realize that, you know, at the end of the day, you got to realize that. So that actually has stayed with me. But then the other piece about the activist mentor, so the whole group thing, and this is a very recent, this is as recent as last night, sort of a little lesson I learned. And that is, I think, one of the things I feel lucky about having learned in this job and now getting both to the age that I am, and now that we are in the last 30 days or so of these jobs, I feel a greater comfort to stand up here on a stage and actually talk about mistakes and be very vulnerable. And I think for those of us who are able to do that and have the experience to do that and have are in jobs that where there's some permission structure to do that, I think we need to do that more because you see us as like the end of my 60-year life here, right? You know, a fully formed kind of person with all this, and you have no idea, like, it really took a lot to get here. I was very vulnerable, very scared about a lot of things. And I've learned this, it was reinforced as recently as last night, because Valerie and I did a program earlier this week or last week, you know, in town on women leaders, and I told a story in a panel about a huge mistake we had made in the early days of the administration, you know, just leaving somebody out at the gate. Actually, it was Queen Noor leaving her out at the gate. So it wasn't just anybody. The press
it was a
noticed.
Disaster.
The press noticed.
God, she was a gracious queen.
Yes, right. And the press were going by because it was the gate that the press come in. It was the whole thing. But I told that story. One of our resident staff members, who's relatively new in a very good senior leadership job, but she's very new to it, stopped me last night and said she had been there and how important it was for her because she was so nervous coming into this job. She wasn't sure she was going to get it. She wasn't sure how she's doing. And she had told her mother about hearing me tell that story last week, and that how much that had meant to her, that somebody like me, the chief of staff to the first lady, would tell this whole story about this mistake and how we got through it, and it was not a big deal, but it felt like a big deal at the time, and it was so important to her. And that just reinforced for me that you actually don't even know, as we're sitting up here in these stages and we do that, and for those of you who do it and you do it, you know, you have no idea how, what effect being able to share that and then how that will resonate with somebody out in the audience for their lives. And so that's been a pretty important thing to learn for me.
Tina and I both turned 60 this year.
Yeah.
Woo, baby. Well, you do start taking more liberties,
yes,
as you get older. Yep. And you can, because the arc of life is long, the mistakes that you made when you were younger, it's helpful. You feel a certain distance from them, so it's easier, but you just also feel a certain confidence. And I think you're absolutely right. We should demystify and humanize ourselves. And as I always say, you can't be what you can't see. But what you see is after 60 years, there was a whole journey, yep, to get here. And we still make mistakes from time to time.
So my next question is about problems that you've seen. So as an 11-year-old girl, I saw diversity lacking in my community, and I noticed that that could be happening all across the country. But I wanted to know that when you were 11, or when you were in my age, like 10 to 16, what problems did you see, and do you think that have you tried to solve them in these positions of power at the Obama administration?
How badly do you think we feel right now? Because at age 11,
you know, I was thinking the same thing.
Oh my goodness.
It was kind of like, what TV show was I watching? What clothes were I wearing?
The hardest thing I did at 11 was beat my dad at chess, which was like a major accomplishment. So you are so much ahead of where I was. I could never have been up on this stage having a conversation with us when I was your age. I'm telling you, I didn't talk to anybody outside of my family. I'd go to a dinner party with my mother and somebody on the other side, and she'd say, you have to turn your head and talk to the person on the other side of you, and I would say, why?
But I think the other piece, Marley, what is so remarkable about you, and actually what I love about the young people that we get to meet in this job is, not in addition to this amazing personality and self-confidence that you have, but that you also have the insight to identify the problem. Because I think actually the first step in a lot of this is we don't see the problem. Because I can't tell you what problem I identified, not because I wasn't like kind of out doing stuff, it's because I didn't see the problem at that age. And I didn't recognize it for what it was, that it was something that I could change and that was external to me and wasn't just like about me. And meet my inadequacies, and that is a remarkable gift that you have that I suspect Mom had something to do with. But it is also a message to give to young people from today who are watching that, you know, identify the problems, you know, look, and then you'll know you can solve them, but I think we've got to name them. You know, all of us who are older have to help our young people name them and name them as problems that aren't about themselves but are about what their environment is, and then they can change that environment.
And, you know, one of the things that we got to see at L.com that I think a lot of folks don't get to see, because they'll see Marley, you know, will be the one person on the stage, but I think it's an insight we also know, for example, from Joanne Smith's work at Girls for Gender Equity, is that Marley is undoubtedly a superstar, but she also has a superstar collective of girls around her, and so she is a real team player. She always has a crew, she's got a squad, and they're doing a lot of collective problem solving and identification. And one of our favorite things this summer was having all those young women together, all those girls together in the L.com offices, and they were actually producing collective responses. And that, I gotta say, for me, I mean, you are, you know, the shine and the moon and the stars, but I also love that you had a whole galaxy with you. It was a wonderful thing.
Thank you. One thing that I try to like tell to adults when they're trying to figure out how do I teach kids to see these problems without overwhelming them is that I say, just show it to them. Just say blatantly, like if you are in a position where your boss is being racist or discriminating against you and your team, you can say that my boss is not being very nice. He is judging me because of, or he's judging my coworker because of the way that we look or the fact that we are different than him. And that my experience is in that I am just as qualified as he am, and that I went to the same school and I got a better degree or and whatever, that I am still as capable and that I can help that problem. And how do you want to help me tell my boss that I don't think I'm being treated fair? Like, there's ways that you can do that. There's ways that you can just take the experiences that you've had and kind of amplify them to show your kids that you can solve these problems with them. Because it makes them afraid when you just say those things, like, my boss is being mean. Then they don't know what to do with themselves. They're just like, I can't help you, because they're not pushing them. They're not pushing them to even try to conceptualize or think of ways to solve problems.
Wow.
No kidding. That's like
she's just making me feel worse and worse. I really am seeing myself at her age and going, what in the world? But I think the reason, I mean, but there are just so many 11-year-old girls around the country watching you right now saying, well, wow, I bet I could do that too. And finding your voice and finding the confidence, as Tina said, not just to identify the problem, but to think that you could actually have an impact on it. And you can start small. I mean, you can start by tutoring a 9-year-old and helping them solve a problem. And you get this positive reinforcement each time. And the question is, how can we help our young girls of color have those early successes? Because that's the foundation you need later in life. And I was a later bloomer. But what we want to do is to create that opportunity for these young girls and figure out what are the obstacles that keep people like you from flourishing around the country, and how do we go about in a very evidence-based way of tackling those obstacles.
So my next question actually linked into it perfectly was that when did you realize that you could use your voice to make a change? And like, how do you, when do you think that girls should really start to get that? Because for me, I think it's middle school, because that's a time where you think
well,
that.
Of course.
That you're, well,
of course you think it's middle school.
When you're in elementary school. When you're in elementary school, you're like, you're too young to obviously sometimes to have. Sometimes to believe that you have the power, but in middle school, you're developing your identity. So for me, it's middle school.
You are the best.
I think it's any age. I mean, I really do. I mean, I think that one of the things about diversity is not just in gender and race, but it's also in development and in personality. And I think we've got to like take everyone as they come, no matter what age. I would, but I knew you were going to ask this question, so I started thinking last night, when was it? And I had a memory, which I had totally forgotten, which was when I was 12, was when Jean McCarthy was running for president of the United States. That's how old I am. You know, and it was during the war. And my father, the whole circumcision thing, actually was very anti-war. You know, taught me to be very anti-war. Had me, like, where I was wearing a black armband to school, went into middle school, you know, all of a sudden. And, you know, I had completely forgotten that really was the start of my political activism. And he just supported me in that. It was kind of edgy to do, you know, back at the time in 1968. But that, you know, it was, again, having a parent who kind of showed me the way on that. So I guess I did start in middle school. What do you know?
I was later. I'm just be honest about it. I remember my first demonstration was actually in college. And it was, I mean, Tina and I grew up in the 60s and 70s, but my college campus was invested in South Africa. And we led a demonstration around the college campus with as many students as we could get, saying, you must divest. And I just remember feeling passionately that I couldn't believe that my tuition payments were going and being invested in a country that believed in apartheid. And I really cared about it. And I remember when all of the college campuses started disinvesting, thinking, that is the power of one. And it's contagious. And once you begin to act like a citizen and begin to hold your your employer, your college, your government accountable, it is it becomes a part of you. And I think that act is of, I can still see myself marching proudly around that campus and feeling so good when our mission was accomplished.
So my one of my final questions is, how do you feel when you are the woman in charge in a room, but you're also, you're the only woman in the room? Like, how do you handle being in those spaces where it's not diverse, but then you still have to lead a group of people and try to explain to them how to help people in diverse communities?
Well, you gotta know your stuff. So that's, I mean, really, my biggest lesson on all of this, what has stepped, you know, me through lots of rooms where I was the only woman and definitely like the only person of color, is that you gotta do your homework and be smarter than, you know, them. And it's not just knowing, I know that I'm pretty smart going into these, but actually you gotta do the homework. And it takes a lot of work because that both, there will come a point in the meeting where you will know more than they do, and that will actually garner you respect. But it also gives you self-confidence when you know going in there that you've kind of like read all the stuff, and you haven't just read the summary material, you've read the stuff down below it. And for me at least, that's part of what gave me self-confidence. And then every now and then, I tended not in my old job at the law firm, not to be somebody who talked about race and gender a lot. It was more about like just doing it. But every now and then, I would sort of take one of my friends, my, you know, white partners, male friends aside and said, all right, did you just see what just happened there? So let me explain to you, because they don't see it. And they are my dear friends and they love me, but don't imagine that they saw the same thing that you saw. And that's some of the way to teach folks, you know, how, because they're not seeing it. And it's not from maliciousness or any ill intent, it's that they just don't see it. And so sometimes you have to quietly and gently sort of, you know, point it out.
So my parents really raised me, and I think because my mom grew up in a segregated Chicago, my dad grew up in a segregated DC, and they said, look, it's not a level playing field. And so anytime I would come home and say, so-and-so happened to me and it wasn't fair, they would say in unison, what makes you think life is fair? And I think children think life should be fair. That's the way we're somehow, we get that societal impression. And I remember I used to just kind of recoil when they said that, and they would couple it with, the best way to tackle unfairness that you're inevitably going to encounter is just be better. And work harder, outwork everybody, take pride in your strength of accomplishment, and don't be afraid to talk. And it doesn't mean you have to be the sole person talking. And I can remember actually being on one of my first corporate boards, and I was terrified, and I was on the board with one of the wealthiest people in Chicago, and I was in awe of being even in his presence. And I can remember sitting in that meeting thinking, I had a question. And I thought it was a stupid question, but I really did have a question, and I didn't ask it. He asked it. He asked it. And I thought, why didn't I ask that question? And later I said to him, you know, I had that same question, and I just thought it was stupid. And he said, there are no stupid questions when you're a board member. And that kind of stuck with me, and it just gets back to a point that Tina made earlier, which is if you're in the room, you're in the room for a reason. And it's one of the things that we have tried to say to empower women here in the White House. And women have a tendency, I think, and this is kind of a big generalization, to hold back a bit. And you have to get in there, and you have to realize that wherever you are in the positions that you're in, you're there because you've earned it. You've probably more than earned it. And tell yourself all the time, and tell your colleagues that, because I think one of the things that we try to do here is to reinforce and support one another and to push us up, because if we're pushing ourselves up, then that's good for what we're trying to do for the president. And we try to say to people, if you're around the table and you have something to say that could improve the conversation and inform the conversation and maybe keep us from making a mistake, and you don't say it, then you're not doing your job. So you have to dig deep, and you have to find your voice, and you have to accept the fact that sometimes you are going to ask stupid questions, and that's okay. The other thing that I think happens, and Tina, I know you, this has happened to you, and it will happen to all of you, is that you'll be at a table, and you'll be the only one, and you'll say something, and nobody will hear you, and then a man will say the same thing you said. You know what I'm talking about? Do you know what I am talking about? And you will say, did I not just say that 10 minutes ago? But this is where I do think you have to recognize that, you know, men are, they need to be helped along. And Tina's point about taking them aside, I think, is a good one. Because if you shame them in the meeting, then they're just mad at you. But you've got to say, you know, did you observe what you just did to me? Because you diminished me by not hearing me. And you also have to figure out ways of speaking so that people can hear you. And it can't always be the loudest voice. Sometimes I lower my voice to try to get people to hear what I'm saying. And that forces them to kind of lean in. And everybody has to find their own voice. And it takes experience and it takes time. But when you find it, you can see the power of the voice.
I want to affirm, again, Marley, how much I appreciated the work that you did in developing the questions today, and how important it was for us to have an opportunity to hear stories as a way of understanding and reflecting on so many of the big policy questions. I also wanted to say to you that I think we, you know, as teachers, as mothers, as mentors, we want our beloved students and daughters and mentees to excel in the world. And we look at a world that is unfair and unjust, and so we tend to say, here are all the ways that you, beloved, can jump over, navigate around, get through it. But I also want to affirm for you that the most important thing that we can do and that you can do, and I see you doing it all the time, and so mostly I'm just hoping to line up behind you while we're doing it, is to actually make the world fairer. So it is unfair. It's deeply unfair. It will be consistently unfair. But our work is, in fact, to try to bring structural change and to try to make the world more just and more fair. And I look at this group of people who I've been so honored to work with in a variety of settings over the course of the past 8 years, and it has been an extraordinary journey. It has been such a pleasure and an honor to have any part of this history where the work of this administration has been to try to lower the barriers, to try to flatten the playing field, to try to level it so that, yeah, we're going to have to keep being extraordinary, but the excellence of black and brown girls is not really a historical question. The question is whether or not history then allows our excellence an opportunity. One of the things I'll say that we're trying to do with the collaborative to advance equity through research is obviously to develop some of that evidence for evidence-based work, but some of it is also just to say this, that for those folks who have helped us over the hurdles, it matters. One of my dearest and closest mentors, Professor Carla Holloway from Duke University, is here in the room. She retired.
Where is she?
She's right over here.
Give me a shout out. Yeah, there you go.
She retired from Duke University after almost a 4-decade career, and the Collaborative to Advance Equity is actually starting our very first funded project, and that is we have a modest gift that we will be giving each year as a mentoring award for those who do in fact mentor women and girls of color, because we do know that it matters to have the people who help us through. And so for folks who want to be part of that effort, it is the Dr. Carla Holloway Award for mentoring.
Great.
We thank you so much for giving us space and time. Marley, you are the thing, the person, the work, the effort, the magic that makes it possible for so many of us to get up in the morning. Tina and Valerie, thank you for the work that you have done for two wonderful, extraordinary terms.
Well, thank you, and thank you all. I mean, Tina and I are spending a lot of time crying these days because we're having a series of laughs, but this is actually a beginning. And I think that the fact that we are all here and have been collectively and individually working on this effort for so many years now, and the momentum that we have built, not just in the White House and throughout the agencies that are part of the White House Council on Women and Girls, but flourishing throughout the country, the partners and the foundations and the business leaders and the advocates who have all come to the table saying, we truly care about women and girls of color, and we are going to go about the business of leveling that playing field. That is the most wonderful gift that you could give us as we come to the close. And so we just want to say how much we appreciate you, how much we love what you're doing and your commitment. And even though the president says that as we pass the baton on to the next administration, we're actually passing the baton on to you. So change the world.
And I will just say that, as Melissa just said, this was historic, and you all were part of history. And once you're in history, you can't undo history, right? So seriously, you will always be a part of this history of the last 8 years. And then I look at Marley and all these young girls who we have had the good fortune to meet, and all the young women who are out there, that you are our hope, and we you are strong and beautiful and loud and proud, and we love you, and you are what is, really giving us great hope that this history really lives on and continues and is just going to grow. So that, I am not crying, I am feeling very, very happy right now. So thank you.